can. We don't have our audience.
The rest of you don't take that personally, that everybody else just left.
Because we're trying not to.
The next case is State versus Castellanos.
Castellanos.
State versus Castellanos.
May it please the court and counsel for the appellee, my name is Timothy Norlinger. I represented Mr. Castellanos at trial and on appeal. Procedurally, these are actually two cases. These were, however, consolidated for appeal as they were at trial because they come out of the same operative facts. The first issue that was alleged in this case revolves around a warrantless entry into a residence here in Lancaster County, Nebraska. As the court is likely aware, under State v. Modlin, found at 291 Nebraska 660, a search without a search warrant is per se unreasonable unless one of the clearly delineated exceptions apply. It's the appellant's position that there isn't an exception and that warrantless entry resulted in a search warrant being issued that without it would have failed to cause the magistrate to issue it.
The state argues the emergency doctrine applied here. Why doesn't it?
Well, Judge, I think that's based almost entirely on the facts, if you'd allow me to go through them. When you look at the emergency doctrine, and I cited some of the cases that I believe are relevant, State v. Eberle is one of them. Eberle is a state case. It involves officers responding to a call of a purported burglary where individuals heard a bang, which could be associated with a gunshot. A gunshot was then the basis under that case for the entry into the residence. I also cited Bingham City v. Stewart, a U.S. Supreme Court case, 547 U.S. 398, which talks about officers seeing a fight occurring inside a residence, a warrantless entry as a result of that. In Michigan versus Fisher, 558 U.S. 45, talking about evidence of broken windows and blood outside. So in those cases, I think there is some reasonable, articulable basis to say that there is something approximating probable cause for an exigency. I don't know that that's the case in this particular matter. First of all, with regard to this offense, on the 19th of February 2016, a single shot was heard by a law enforcement officer near the 800 block of South 17th Street here in Lancaster County. At the same time, a report came in of a single gunshot. The individuals that were in the vehicle where this occurred were named Mackenzie Hogger, Ed Harris, and Sarah Nosgoff. The officer that first hears this shot responds to that location. She can tell immediately, looking at the B pillar, which is the area between the two cars, that there's a shotgun pellet there because of the way that shotguns disperse.
So you'd agree that the officers arriving were dealing with some exigent circumstances.
But they are entirely contained outside of the apartment we're talking about.
But when they're going to investigate, the officer sees the first individual with the towel, then sees the appellant come out of an apartment, correct?
Well, Judge,
and then they flee.
Well, that's correct, but if you would allow me, the residence that we're talking about is at 1609 D Street. The individuals that were present when this shooting occurred in the 1600 block, in fact, don't point to 1609. They point to 1623.
So aren't they adjacent?
They're next to each other. The officer says, that's where I'm going. The only reason I get interested in 1609 is I see somebody in this apartment, and I want to canvass him and ask him questions. Now, what she then testified to is she goes to the front door of this apartment. It's locked. There's no signs of forced entries. There's no signs of struggle. There's no blood trail. There's nothing associated with the shooting or anything being brought into that residence. The individual inside does have something underneath a white towel, bath mat of some kind, and flees out the back. But I think it's important to note that flight in and of itself is not something that even approximates reasonable suspicion, and that's found through State v. Ellington at 242 Nebraska 550.
Is that following a gunshot and seeing someone with a towel covering something?
That's with a hand-to-hand transaction in a high-drug area.
So a little different.
Well, I would agree it's different, but there's also, if that's not reasonable suspicion, officers, based on their training and experience under Ellington, think a drug transaction is occurring. I don't know that there's much difference here between those two. What would be the argument of the appellant?
Wasn't there a boot print on the door and evidence that the door may have been kicked in?
Well, there is evidence on the apartment door of a boot print. I would tell you that based on the record in this case, the door being kicked in was not apparent to anyone until they'd actually opened the door and gone through and done this warrantless entry into the residence, Your Honor. That, I think, is important because when you look at the record before it, this apartment is completely locked on the outside. There's no indication that anyone broke the back or the front door based on the record before the court. And in addition to that, there's no indication that anyone's injured inside because there's no blood, there's no cries for help, there's nothing other than a boot print which the officers can't identify how long ago it was with regard
to. There was evidence of something that appeared to be blood on the white towel or bath mat that was covering the gun?
There was evidence of a red substance on the gun. That was testified to by Officer Richard Rowe. However, when you look at his testimony, what he says is that it's not viscous, it's dried. So it would be the appellant's argument here that we have a single gunshot, it occurs outside the residence, and there's nothing indicating that there's some sort of individual in harm's way located inside this apartment, especially when you look at the facts that the officer that opened the door for this warrantless entry into the residence knows that the appellant lives there, and the officer that saw him leave the area saw him close the door behind. So we know the person leaving is the person that lives there, and he closed the door behind him. I don't know that just based on a dried substance that may or may not be blood and turns out to be candle wax is sufficient to justify an exigent circumstance.
So even if the warrantless entry was unlawful?
Correct.
Wasn't there an independent basis for the search warrant?
Well, Judge, I don't think so, because without the... That would be the argument of the appellant, because the facts would have to be the same. Without the warrantless entry, you take out, with regard to the search warrant, as this court is aware, all the things found with regard to entry into the residence.
Which really was just the marijuana.
Well, it was drugs, correct, which substantiated or added to the probable
cause. But after that point, wasn't there other evidence now available? You have the weapons that were located on the path where the fleeing people took. And
well, there was the one gun that was found on the path. The interesting thing is the shotgun, the gun that was actually used to fire this at this vehicle, was found propped up on a privacy fence with no indication it had ever been inside the apartment complex, let alone the apartment of the appellant that was entered into it.
Wasn't it in the same general location, though, where they fled?
It was not, based on the officers. It was found in a corner resting upright. There was no indication other than the thing that Mr. Cushing, the person that fled first, had in his hand, and that was found to be this .22 with the round, what they call stovepiped in it, which means that it was attempted to be put into the magazine and it got stuck looking up. And so, in my mind, based on the evidence that was at trial and at the motion to suppress, there was no indication how that shotgun got there, nor was there any forensics tying the appellant or Mr. Cushing to it. There was a major contributor on the DNA that was found not to be either one of these individuals. I'll reserve the rest of my time. So.
Thank you.
Good afternoon, Your Honors. May it please the Court, Nathan Liss, Assistant Attorney General, appearing on behalf of the appellee of the State of Nebraska. The State maintains that Mr. Castellanos is not entitled to relief on any of his three assignments of error. If time permits, I'll briefly address all three issues. As far as the first issue, the warrantless entry into Mr. Castellanos' apartment, we submit that it was justified under the exigent circumstances under the emergency doctrine.
What was the emergency?
Well, looking at all the evidence collectively, the emergency was that they thought there was some type of home invasion and that these two individuals may have been involved in the shooting.
Why? I mean, why would they have thought there was a home invasion with the single shotgun that was heard outside? They found the vehicle that it ultimately hit. So how does that get me inside this apartment?
Well, after the shot and after they've apprehended the two individuals, they're coming back and retracing the path they took. They find the two guns. They find the white bath towel, which they testified appeared to contain blood. They speak with Mr. Cushing, who says he's not sure what happened, but he believes that there may have been a home invasion robbery of Mr. Castellanos' apartment. They know that Mr. Castellanos is involved in a gang. That gang is known to be affiliated with firearms. They're investigating shootings attributable to that gang. I think given all that and the fact that there could be what appears to be a retaliatory shooting that has just taken place, gives them a reasonable basis to believe that something might have occurred in that apartment, and they had just fled.
Isn't the emergency, though, of life or property inside?
Yes.
Who are they worried about?
Well, they don't know. That's the problem. They aren't sure. I mean, but given that you've just got a shooting that's taken place, these individuals flee, you find two guns, both of which have live ammunition in them, or I guess one was expelled, but the other has a jammed projectile in it. I mean, a gun's going to cool off in a matter of seconds. A towel with apparent blood, a boot print on the door. One of the two individuals saying, I think a home invasion might have occurred here. One individual who's affiliated with gangs. I mean, given the totality of the circumstances, I think there's really nothing unreasonable whatsoever about concluding that they would need to go in here.
Is there a timing when... Who was the guy who thought there might be a home invasion when he arrived?
Mr. Cushing.
Is there a timing when he arrived versus when this all happened?
I don't think the record reflects when he arrived, or at least he didn't provide that detail to the police. They didn't relay that, but I mean, they did testify that prior to going into the apartment, they spoke with him about what was going on. I don't think they got any statements from Mr. Castellanos, but Mr. Cushing said, I don't know what is going on here, but I think there might have been a home invasion.
To the extent the warrantless entry was unlawful, what is the evidence that would support an independent basis for the search warrant?
Well, I don't know that it would necessarily be or have to be independent. I think the same circumstances that we have here would provide a viable argument that the inevitable discovery doctrine applies.
What I mean is that you can't rely on, if it was unlawful, you can't rely on, say, the marijuana that was seen there, right, to the extent that created probable cause for the search warrant. What other evidence was there, if you exclude that evidence, what other evidence would have supported that search warrant?
The only evidence you're going to have is the same evidence we've just been discussing that would have justified
the finding of the
going in there. Right. The rationale would be that if that didn't rise to the level of an emergency, that it nonetheless provided probable cause for which they would have and could have obtained a warrant and gone in despite maybe the absence of an emergency. But, I mean, it's our position that in light of all of this information, we did have an emergency. And the standard is that of an objective person. It's an objective standard that, based on the ordinary person of reasonable caution, would they conclude that given all the information that it would be warranted to go into this apartment to, render aid if necessary or to check for protection of life or property?
Is the emergency doctrine the only exigent factor that was presented and argued? Okay, so you couldn't really decide this based on other exigent factors like potential destruction of evidence or believing a suspect to still be in the premises. That was never argued.
That wasn't argued below, but that's a legal basis. I mean, you're talking about whether or not you have a violation of the Fourth Amendment. I mean, that's a de novo determination by this court. So whether that's argued or advocated below, the facts are what they are. I mean, with respect to that issue, the only thing you're reviewing for in terms of what happened below is clear error.
Because at that time, they don't know who actually shot at this vehicle, right? And they have individuals fleeing from this particular apartment area.
Right.
But it wasn't, it didn't seem to be positioned that way to the court when it was argued.
I'm sorry, what?
It seems the focus was entirely on the emergency doctrine as a basis for exigent circumstances.
Yeah, I believe that's correct, Your Honor. I guess my only point is that the fact that the state may limit its argument below or its theory of why evidence is admissible under the Fourth Amendment doesn't mean that this court is precluded from considering a different avenue. For instance, the inevitable discovery argument was not made below. That doesn't preclude this court from considering it. If you look at both State v. Oliveira Coutinho and State v. Nolte, inevitable discovery wasn't raised below in either of those cases, but the Nebraska Supreme Court applied it in both cases. Similarly, good faith doesn't have to be raised below. It can be raised for the first time on appeal. The appellate court can apply that, and it often does, because that's a no-law determination reviewed independently of the trial court's determination. But I think the emergency doctrine here would be the most applicable. I think it made sense that that was the state's argument below, and that's been our primary argument on appeal as well. We maintain that it applies here.
Talk about the 22 rifle?
Sure, yeah. As far as the second issue, the admission of Mr. Lawrence's testimony about the 22 rifle that was stolen from his house, we maintain that was properly admitted at trial because it was inextricably intertwined with Mr. Castellanos' charge for felon in possession of a firearm. The state's theory below with respect to the firearms was that Mr. Castellanos was guilty of possessing either or both of the firearms in question, and with respect to the 22 rifle, which was confirmed to be the 22 stolen from Mr. Lawrence's house, the state's theory was that Mr. Castellanos was guilty because of either constructive possession or actual possession, since he had stolen that from Mr. Lawrence's house. Mr. Lawrence's testimony was obviously vital to that theory on that charge, so we would submit that the district court correctly concluded it's inextricably intertwined with the state's charge on that offense.
Was there any evidence by the appellant that contradicted the testimony of the person from the lab who was able to identify the defaced serial number? Was there anything counter to that?
No, not that I recall. I mean, the evidence reflected that Mr. Lawrence had a document on his computer, that his computer had initially crashed, but he turned it over to police. They retrieved this document, which contained the serial number, and then the gun is, you know, ultimately examined by the State Patrol Crime Lab. They do a chemical analysis and evaluate the defaced serial number, and it matches. So, and to my recollection, there was no dispute.
Nothing to
counter
that.
No, right. Just briefly on the third issue, if there's nothing further on that, on the denial of the proposed instruction on the meaning of possession, we maintain that the jury was properly instructed on the meaning of possession. The instruction given was consistent with the statute, our case law, and the applicable instruction from NJI. So we maintain that the jury was properly instructed and there was no need for the proposed instructions by Mr. Castellanos. If there are no further questions, we would ask you to affirm the judgment of the district court. Thank you.
Thank you. How much time does Mr. Norlinger have? A minute.
May it please the court. With regard to the warrantless entry, I will just note State versus Gilbo, 214 Nebraska 904. The court needs to look and see if you took out the warrantless entry, if there's still probable cause based on the search warrant. The search warrant is in the record. It would be the appellant's position that without the drugs found in the residence and the other information about the firearms, or I should say the ammunition, that would render that search warrant invalid.
The ammunition's the most damaging evidence.
Correct. And with regard to the inextricably linked, I would point the court to the last Supreme Court decision on that, State v. Ash. It's 286 Nebraska 681. In that case, the court says that courts should avoid applying inextricably intertwined too broadly, or it eviscerates the protections given to the accused under 404 subsection 2. In that case, it was about a murder where someone had pawned the jacket of the alleged victim just prior to it. It seems that if that should have been remanded because that was too broad given 2 days' time period, when you look at the evidence in this case, it should be the same. Here we're talking about Mr. Lawrence saying this gun went missing sometime between Christmas and New Year's of 2016 to 2017, over 2 months before the possession in this case. The 22 was never found in the possession of Mr. Castellanos, nor was there any forensic evidence tying him to it. It was being carried by Mr. Cushing. It appears to have been disposed of by Mr. Cushing. When you look at the testimony of Mr. Lawrence, it also indicates that Mr. Castellanos was last seen at the residence prior to the gun went missing, and he also indicated that there were a number of other individuals that would come and go from that house visiting the other residents, Rebecca.
So wasn't his testimony actually helpful for your client, really?
Well, potentially, but it would have been nice to have a limiting instruction included in that, which, because of the court's finding that it was inextricably intertwined, the defendant was deprived of at trial, which I think would have affected the weight the jury would have given to it, and that's the reason that we have those instructions both at the time of presenting the evidence and as part of the final jury instruction in this case.
Thanks.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Case is submitted. Counsel is excused.